And welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yu, and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Katie Bors. Last week, we were expecting a second cabinet meeting at which Theresa May would reveal her Brexit deal. It never did happen, but tensions are running high in the Conservative Party. James, what can we expect from the week ahead?
There'll be cabinet on Tuesday, as there always is. I think the expectation, though, now is that there'll be another cabinet later in the week, maybe Wednesday, maybe Thursday, which will discuss the kind of outlines of where the Brexit deal is heading, which is now all about the backstop and how the UK can get out of it. There is a big problem for Theresa May in that it looked like she could basically get most of the cabinet to reluctantly accept some kind of mutual review mechanism for leaving the backstop. So it's not as simple as the UK just saying, we want to leave and being allowed to leave the backstop, but you would be able to say that the EU couldn't veto the UK leaving. It wasn't that simple. There'd be kind of arbitration. This is what Geoffrey Cox, the Attorney General, was saying he thought could be made to work. The EU, which don't like arbitration, are not keen on that. So that appears now not to be a runner, which makes working how to get out of this situation much, much more difficult.
Katie, we have Roddy Robbins and Sabine Weyand in Brussels today. I mean, can we expect anything today or tomorrow?
I think it's one of those things where we know there has to be a decision at some point quite soon. Even though we've been saying there has to be a decision for, you know, 7 months now, it really is getting to the point that if the government want to prevent going into the serious no-deal planning, the point of no-deal planning where you start to spend millions and millions, perhaps even more, enacting things so you get them into an almost prepared stage for when Britain actually leaves, they need to get this deal moving. And that means that by the end of the week, they really need to be able to say we have some kind of agreement in Brussels or the making of one so they can get to this EU Council November summit. So it feels, although there do seem to be some very big obstacles, just because of the way the timing is, you can't rule out the fact that you could get to Thursday, Friday, and suddenly there's some kind of announcement or, you know, there's some positive mood music. But that said, the increasing feeling I am getting from speaking to people is that the problems are looking increasingly insurmountable when it comes to getting agreement. That doesn't mean Theresa May isn't going to come back for something. It just means that it could be dead on arrival.
So this week's cabinet meeting was notionally when they were meant to decide whether to book space on commercial ferries to bring in essential supplies into the country in the event of a no-deal Brexit. Now, whether that decision gets taken on Tuesday, I doubt it. I think they probably will try and avoid trying to take decisions like that at this moment in the talks because things are so delicate. But, as someone inside government was saying to me the other day, you know, if it becomes clear that there isn't going to be a November summit, which isn't currently scheduled, but the EU haven't kind of said there definitely won't be one, but if it becomes clear that the timing's on that, given that this deal will need to go to the EU member states for them to have a look at, just clearly isn't going to work, the danger is that when the two sides go to the December summit, they will both be in the middle of proper no-deal planning. They'll both be attending that summit in a no-deal footing. Now, the optimists might say, well, that could concentrate minds. You know, that could make people realise what the consequences of this are and might help both sides come to a deal. Or a pessimist could say, once you start doing all this stuff, once you start telling companies what's going to happen, you know, you take some of the economic hit of no deal, and essentially then it becomes a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. You're on this track and it's very hard to act. It takes kind of act of will to get off it. But as Katie said, the Commons maths is becoming more and more difficult because, you know, Joe Johnson didn't just resign on Friday. He said he would vote against the withdrawal agreement. Now, I think there are about half a dozen Tories on the Remain wing of the party who are now on the record as saying that they'll vote against the withdrawal agreement. If you then add to that the number of Tories, you know, even if you think that you can get the number of ERG rebels against the withdrawal agreement down to 20, the numbers are still incredibly tight and you would need Labour support. And that, obviously, how much Labour support you would need would increase quite dramatically if the government loses the DUP, which at the moment, last week, suggested that the DUP were not in any way happy with where things were heading.
And then I think you add to that the reports about the negotiations that you just mentioned, Cindy, so the technical side. And there is this feeling that instead of, you know, looking at Theresa May's domestic situation and saying, well, we've pushed him on, you know, the terms of this Northern Ireland specific backstop, you know, let's try and make some room here. It does seem that actually Brussels is smelling a sense of desperation on the time and on the clock and is trying to push through even more things that will be even more unsatisfactory to the UK side. So whether or not what is going to happen to the UK fishing waters, an issue which is not the biggest financial impact on the UK if the EU were to, but politically that would be very negative because a lot of people, particularly in Scotland, got behind Brexit on the basis that they would take back control of the waters. Then you're also hearing about these level playing field clauses which would tie the UK's hands if they are in it, and that's also adding to the point that these things are all very unsatisfactory, but if you put them in an indefinite backstop which the UK can't choose to leave, they get even worse. So I think that's also what's making it more difficult, the fact that Brussels is seizing the fact that there is turmoil in the UK situation, try and make things even worse for the UK side.
Yeah, and James, do we know more about these level playing field requirements? Or what are the most stringent ones that we might be facing?
It's obviously going to be the obvious stuff, which is the social and environmental rules and state aid, and the kind of question again of who assesses whether the UK is complying with these standards. You know, if it is the European Court of Justice, Theresa May crosses one of her red lines, which was about the ECJ not having jurisdiction over the UK after Brexit. So I think this is where things become very, very difficult. I think the other issue here, in a way, is, as Katie said, you know, Jeremy Hunt's complaint that he's making in private is, you know, by advertising how keen we are to get a deal on this timetable, you're almost encouraging the other side to come up with more and more demands. I think the interesting thing is we're not seeing from the EU, and you can say, obviously you can say it's not their responsibility, but you're not seeing from them thinking, okay, we're going to try and work out how Theresa May can get this over the line. They're simply thinking about driving the best possible bargain for them, which is obviously understandable on their part, but also does increase the chances of no deal.
And at some point, the Brexit deal would have to go before Parliament. And like James said, the Conservatives might need Labour support. Katie, but does Labour know what it wants on Brexit?
Well, Labour's Brexit position, as it has been for some time and some years, is still evolving. Right. And Jeremy Corbyn did manage to upset probably a lot of Labour members who we know are quite pro-EU by nature when he gave an interview to a German newspaper at the weekend, and he said that Brexit cannot be stopped. I think given the fact that the UK government is looking less than sturdy on the Brexit issue, and there's talk of a second referendum, there's talk of an early election, there's talk of this deal collapsing, you can see how if the opposition decided to start arguing for stopping Brexit, it would be difficult electorally for some of their voters, but you can see how it wouldn't sound as absurd, perhaps, as it would have sounded, you know, about a year ago. So I think his clear statement that this was not at all possible, not even a small possibility, went down quite badly. But we've now had Keir Starmer, the shadow Brexit secretary, go on the Today programme and say that Brexit can be stopped. He's not saying it's Labour's position, but he's saying there is still a possibility of that. Do you think, though, that actually, although this is a new divide to some degree, it does reflect what happened at Labour conference, which was that the Labour leadership in Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell, his close comrade, were very clear that they weren't going to support a second referendum in the way that a lot of members wanted. So you had lots of to-ing and fro-ing about the form of that statement. Then when it came out and it appeared to give way to, you know, a very small chance of a second referendum, John McDonnell then gave an interview saying, well, yes, maybe we would, but it would be to take the deal or go to no deal. So he was saying Remain would not even feature in the second referendum. Keir Starmer used his speech at Labour conference to say that, you know, a second referendum was possible and Remain was an option. So I think that this is the same divide as we've heard before, but it's interesting that they're still not able to resolve that. I guess, though, it means, given that the power really lies with Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell, Keir Starmer's statement doesn't mean as much as Jeremy Corbyn's fact that Labour is not going to support this.
I mean, there are two big questions here. One is Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell, they are not pro-EU politicians. And the second is Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell, you know, John McDonnell is kind of on the record of saying this, if you want to be really radical in the way that they do, weirdly enough, the more chaos there is before you enter government, the better. You've got the opportunity to say, everything is up in the air, so we're going to reorientate the economy in the following ways, which obviously, if there was a deal to stay in the EU, they wouldn't have that same freedom, partly because of single market rules, but also partly because people wouldn't be open to such radical solutions in those circumstances.
And in other news, there are rumours today that there is a split in the Treasury. Katie, what have we heard about Philip Hammond and Liz Truss, his deputy's relationship?
So this is a story in The Times, which is suggesting that Liz Truss, the chief secretary to the Treasury, has been sidelined by Philip Hammond, the Chancellor. And they cite the budget as an example of where this was happening. So Liz Truss, who you'd think in a way, you know, is second in command in the Treasury, was kept out of quite a few of the meetings on the budget. It was just the Chancellor and his closest aides. And it meant that some of her ideas weren't listened to. And I think it's quite interesting. The paper cites some of the things that Liz Truss came up with. Quite a few of them are policies or ideas on funding for education. Given that education was probably the thing going away from the fix on betting terminal row, the biggest thing that Hammond was criticised for in his budget. So the fact there wasn't much fresh money for schools.
For his little extras.
Yeah, and he used his tin ear to say that it was the little extras by giving them a smaller amount than they were giving to fix the potholes in the road. I would say Liz Truss comes out quite well in this story. But the other thing they point out that there is friction over is the fact that Liz Truss is actually quite optimistic about Brexit. All kind of breaks rank with the Treasury thinking, which is a softest Brexit possible is the best way forward. Whereas Liz Truss, although she was Remain in the EU referendum, has since come around to say that if we are going to leave the EU, we need to make sure that we have the ability to make our own rules and take advantage that way. And that's not necessarily what Philip Hammond thinks.
James, the rumour is that Philip Hammond isn't happy with Liz Truss because she went to the pizza club that Andrea Leadsom hosted. Do you put much stock in this split or indeed its Brexit motivation?
I don't think it will be... Look, I think Liz Truss in Cabinet has sounded a very different note to Philip Hammond on Brexit for quite some time. I suspect that's the origin of the tension, you know, which is, yeah, and it must be, and I suspect it is particularly galling for Philip Hammond because, you know, the Treasury like to have all the economic departments, you know, if it is him and Greg Clark, the business secretary, arguing for the same position, you know, you don't want someone else from a finance department kind of arguing a different way. And obviously, though, you know, Liz Truss has her own seat round the cabinet table as a minister attending cabinet. You know, she's allowed to say what she wants. I think the other thing that you've got to remember is as well, Philip Hammond kept this budget incredibly tight. You know, he was so worried about leaks that when he briefed the cabinet just hours before the budget, he didn't tell them about the extra money for universal credit because he thought that might kind of get out there in advance and
not
ruin
sure
his
why
moment.
He would think that.
So I think there's a kind of tension inherent there, you know, and also, you know, which is that, you know, Hammond likes to keep things very tight. I also think that Philip Hammond is not naturally a very collegiate person. I think it's very telling that after Amber Rudd left the cabinet, you know, they've got them going again now, but those meetings of pro-EU cabinet ministers kind of fell away because simply no one organised them.
James and Katie, thanks very much. And if you like this podcast, do subscribe, rate and review us on the iTunes Store. And if you'd like to subscribe to The Spectator, then you can get a month's free trial when you go to spectator.co.uk/trial. And you can cancel at any time. Thanks for listening and do join us again tomorrow.